Calling State Affairs to order at 3:01 p.m. Thursday, January 23. Martha, will you please call the roll?
Representative Hodkins?
Present.
Representative Story?
Present.
Representative
Thompson?
Here. Representative Vance?
Here.
Representative Shaw?
Here.
Representative Fields?
Here.
Representative Christ
Thompson? Here. With seven of seven members present, we have a quorum to conduct business. We're also joined by Representatives Jackson and Rauscher. Welcome to the committee today. As a reminder to everyone, please silence your cell phones. Thank you, Martha, as with last year, for helping keep records for the committee, and to Carson and Nate in the back with LIO. We have two items on today's agenda, House Bill 187, relating to out-of-state correctional facilities, sponsored by Representative Fields. I believe Representatives Rauscher and Jackson may also make comments. And then also House Joint Resolution 15, sponsored by myself, relating to veto override vote thresholds. Starting with House Bill 187, Representative Fields, this is your legislation. This is also a first hearing in State Affairs. I think a reminder for all members, a couple of sort of customs of the committee with legislation. Even for the most perfunctory of bills, we always have two hearings. So the first hearing is usually an introductory hearing. We'll hear public testimony in the second hearing, also have an opportunity for amendments. The sponsor has invited testimony for the first hearing, which we'll hear today. Representative Fields, introductory comments on HB 187.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. And I know that Representative Jackson has another committee commitment, so with your indulgence, I'm going to let her just say a few words first about her interest in this subject.
Thank you. Through the chair, for the record, my name is Representative Sharon Jackson from Eagle River, Chugayak, and Jay Bear Joint Base, Elmendorf, Richardson. I would like to thank the sponsor of this bill for allowing me to offer this amendment. I am supportive of this bill, HB 187. I think it is important for a variety of reasons, most importantly, to keep Alaskans in their home state in which they will eventually re-enter society. This amendment is straightforward. It adds a third exemption to allow the Commissioner of Corrections to send 9 Alaskan prisoners and prisoners sentenced to serve 99 plus years out of Alaska if there will be significant savings by doing so. And with that, I'll turn it over to my staff, Elijah Verhagen, to go into detail or answer any questions you may have.
Thanks. And I'm not sure when you want to discuss this amendment, if you want to go through the bill first, but I just want to make sure Representative Jackson could speak because she has other commitments. So do you want me to go through the bill presentation now?
Yeah, let's go through the bill presentation first, and Mr. Verhagen, we can call you up later on to dive into the amendment if that sounds good. Thank you, Representative Jackson.
Okay, so I'm going to give a second for pulling up the presentation. Okay, House Bill 187, pretty simple bill, prohibits sending Alaskans outside or to private prisons. The only exceptions currently in the bill are for limited circumstances, such as an inmate needs to be shipped outside for specialized medical treatment they can't get in Alaska, for extradition for an inmate who's not actually from Alaska, or in a circumstance where perhaps an inmate's family has moved out of state, so actually to be closer to their family, out of state incarceration would make more sense. Other than those exceptions, this bill would prevent privatization of prisons within the state of Alaska, and it would also prohibit shipment of prisoners to outside private prisons. And I think it's important to note this bill is very consistent with the legislature's past work on this subject, notably Senate Bill 64 in 2004, when the legislature on a bipartisan basis ended a practice of sending prisoners outside, and the legislature at the time ended that practice because of the negative effects of sending prisoners outside and having them bring gangs back into Alaska. You know, last year we passed an important piece of legislation, House Bill 49, to strengthen sentences. That bill also included language to improve reentry programs And the bill before you today ensures that we can incarcerate and provide reentry programs to prisoners here in Alaska. I think those of us who have had an opportunity to observe, interact with Department of Corrections staff know how committed our staff is to rehabilitation and reentry programs. There are rehabilitation and reentry coalitions throughout the state, in the Mat-Su, Kenai, Fairbanks, rural communities, and very strong reentry coalitions here in Juneau and in Anchorage. And those reentry coalitions really can't do their work if the prisoners are thousands of miles away in a privately run facility. Little more background on private prisons in Alaska. You know, the practice of sending prisoners outside decades ago began perhaps innocently enough. It was seen as a temporary solution, but it ended up metastasizing and being really hard to bring those prisoners back. And I just hope that we would stay consistent with the policies that Governor Murkowski and former legislators put in place when they funded the construction of Goose Creek. And I just want to quote from Governor Murkowski: over a decade of gridlock has led to the failure to improve what was supposed to be a temporary solution of sending prisoners to Arizona. This bill, he's referring to Senate Bill 75, would generate good paying long-term jobs for Alaskans and end the export of over $14 million per year to Arizona. And just to put a finer point on it, you know, thinking about Palmer Correctional Center, we're looking at nearly 100 jobs. Are we going to have these jobs for Alaskans, largely in the valley, or are we going to have those jobs be outside? Just a little more background. We have had significant local government interests in this, and multiple jurisdictions from the interior to Anchorage to the Kenai have said they don't want prisoners within their limits. And some of these communities are places where private prison companies had contemplated operating. I think it's important to know the legislature has already appropriated enough money to open Palmer Medium, according to DOC's internal documents that we discussed at the last House State Affairs hearing in January. I think most of y'all were attending either in person or telephonically. I think at this point the safety risks of private prisons are well understood, so I'll just review this quickly. At the last hearing we had, I thought it was remarkable to hear the consistency of testimony from correctional officers, from former inmates, from the spouses of current inmates, and from academic experts that, unfortunately, the understaffing that is pervasive in private prisons leads to the formation of gangs. And what we heard at the last hearing is that, you know, sometimes these gangs form because prisoners feel like in a context of a private prison that's very violent, they actually need protection. So the Native Brotherhood, we heard at the last hearing, was actually formed by Alaska Natives who were being victimized in private prisons, and they formed this gang to protect themselves. But unfortunately, where you have an environment that's unsafe in an outside private prison, you have the proliferation of gangs. And of course, when those inmates come back to Alaska, they bring the gangs with them. And what you see pictured here is a photo from the ADN of the 1488s, a white supremacist gang that unfortunately came back to Alaska after Alaskans learned about this gang in outside prisons. So I think when we're hearing the same thing from correctional officers, inmates, spouses of inmates, subject matter experts, we should listen. The simple fact is we will never have as strong of rehabilitation and reentry programs at private outside prisons as we will at, say, PCC. That's what we heard from the corrections officers. That's what we heard from former inmates and folks who work in reentry. And I think the logistics of it are pretty simple. To have successful reentry, you have to stay connected with your family while you're on the inside. And as you approach your release time, you have to be working with folks on the outside, these reentry coalitions that include a lot of nonprofit providers, housing, treatment, job entry. It's impossible to do that coordination when folks are housed outside. And it's important to note that these reentry activities don't just occur right before prisoners are released. A lot of them, it's called InReach, are community nonprofits. A lot of them are faith-based that do InReach to inmates throughout the term of their incarceration. And that's really important because for an inmate who's incarcerated for a longer period of time, they might have the opportunity to go through a longer-term training program, whether that's getting their GED or whether it's doing, for example, one of the apprenticeship programs that are offered at Highland. If we were to prohibit shipment of prisoners outside to private prisons, that would be very consistent with actions of both the federal government and other states. And the Bureau of Prisons and the Department of Justice have documented that there are more problems with sexual misconduct, contraband, lockdowns, and inmate discipline at private prisons. At the last hearing, we heard from inmates that you have more drugs infiltrating private prisons for the very simple reason that private prison guards aren't well compensated. So it's all too easy to bribe them and to get them to bring drugs inside. Quick rundown of other states. At this point, about almost half of other states have banned or discontinued the use of private prisons. Florida is a state with a fairly long experience using private prisons, and based on that experience, we now know that actually, according to the Department of Corrections and some independent analysis, private prisons were actually more expensive than incarcerating inmates in public in-state facilities. So I think that's a good overview of the bill. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Representative Fields. Any questions from the committee on HB 187? I should also add that available for questions online are Commissioner Nancy Dahlstrom from Department of Corrections and also Claire Radford from Legislative Legal. Representative Story.
And I'm glad to hear the commissioners online. Thank you, Representative Fields, for this bill. I know that this was the intent of the legislature to move forward and open Palmer, and I recognize this bill is probably as a result of that not happening. And if I could hear from the commissioner about why the legislative intent was not followed, that would help.
My understanding. Commissioner Dahlstrom, would you be able to speak to Representative Story's question?
Thank you, Co-Chair Christ-Tompkins. Yes, through the Chair, Representative Story, this is Nancy Dahlstrom, Commissioner, Department of Corrections. And I first just want to say good afternoon and thank you for the opportunity to talk with you today. It's always good to be with this group. And I would like to thank Rep. Fields for the very kind and very true words that he just spoke about the employees of the Department of Corrections and those people who are involved in reentry. He did a wonderful job of describing them. I will say that they are fantastic, dedicated people, and I think very, very highly of them. So I have some information that I would like to share with you all today. You all know that our Department of Corrections population has grown. It's continuing to grow since the implementation of House Bill 49. This trend we do expect to continue. As of today, our population is 97.3%. And you all know that in October I announced that the department would issue an RFP to house prisoners out of state. So today I'm announcing publicly, and you are the first to hear it publicly, is that I have signed a notice of cancellation for that RFP. And I want to talk just a little bit about, from the beginning, the RFP was just one of the tools that I was considering and using for addressing the population management. We have been consistently and from the start looking at any and all viable alternative options. So in this process, we've been able to identify some in-state solutions that are going to address our growing population and provide an immediate relief to the burden on our system. So again, I am not going to be awarding a contract. The timing of the committee today gave me the perfect opportunity to share this information with you, and like I said, you're the first to publicly hear this information. So thank you so much, and Rep. Fields, again, thank you so much again for acknowledging the dedication of the DOC employees.
Representative Thompson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Through the Chair, Commissioner, this is Rep. Steve Thompson. Out of curiosity, how many of our prison beds are being filled by incarcerated people that are waiting to go to trial? And of those that are waiting to go to trial, how many of them are nonviolent, not a risk to society, and could be released on ankle monitors? And where are we at in that process? Thank you.
Thank you, Rep. Thompson, through the chair. I can tell you that over 51% of our population is unsentenced. I today cannot give you any stats on how many are violent, nonviolent, and the EM numbers, but I will tell you that my Deputy Commissioner Kelly Good is in the room with you, and she can address some particulars on that. But we do continue to look at ways that we can refine that. We've made requests to Department of Law and the courts, and they are working with us. But specifically, over 51% of the population is unsentenced.
Thank you.
Representative Vance.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I do have a question for Commissioner Dahlstrom as well. And let's see, I have quite a few. Let me get my train of thought on this. More specifically, with this announcement that you've made about finding solutions within the state, are we privy to that, of what those solutions are today?
Thank you, Representative Vance, through the chair. What I can tell you is that we are working on developing a CRC, which is a community resource center, and turning it into a pilot reentry project. And as Rev Fields and several of you have talked about, reentry is extremely important. And I can't speak to the specifics right now because some things are still getting worked out, but it will be a pilot that I believe will be successful. And we also are immediately starting the process of addressing the life, fire, and safety issues at Palmer Correctional to open that facility.
Follow-up?
Follow-up.
Do you have a timeline on the pilot project, a projected hopeful timeline, and also a timeline on the safety to open Palmer Correctional?
Thank you, Rep. Vance, through the chair. I'm going to say 90 days for the pilot to get things going, give or take a few days. And the estimates that we have from our in-house group on the work that needs to be done in Palmer is 12 to 18 months, but I will tell you that we are going to accelerate that as quick as we safely can.
Follow-up?
Yes, thank you. The last meeting that we had, you had given a small update on correctional officers. What is your current status on the number of correctional officers that are still needed in order to maintain safety levels?
Thank you, Rep. Vance, through the chair. We currently, I don't know what it is about the number 90, but I have 90 open CO positions. I want you to remember I have over 900 employees, so 90 is a lot, and we are continuing our recruiting efforts, and we are having some good successes with that. We also are recruiting for probation officers, parole officers, medical folks to work in our institutions, and, of course, our maintenance and, you know, all the clerical and things that go on. A big thing we have started is we have a $5,000 hiring bonus for new correctional officers, and that has gotten quite a bit of talk from correctional officers, and we look forward to being able to reward that. We have identified new target audiences. We have expanded our outreach. We are going to job fairs all around the state, coordinating with Department of Labor on that, and also coordinating with our officers and other DOC employees to attend those job fairs so that they can answer the questions, you know, from somebody who actually does the job. And we have been reviewing and modifying our hiring process to identify the barriers. We've been able to shorten the timeline, which is, you know, more efficient. But we've also looked at the interview questions and said what might be possibly outdated questions or not the best question that could be asked now to determine job capacity. And there's contacts in each facility who are working with folks who have applied to keep them updated on the status of where their application is. And all this is part of our goal so that we can be stabilized and have sufficient officers and employees before Palmer opens.
Thank you. Representative Rauscher?
Thank you. And I do have a hoarse voice today, but first I'd like to just thank the committee for the chance to sit here amongst you today. That was a very generous offer by Representative Fields. I guess you all know that I sit in District 9, and District 9 is where Palmer Correctional Center is, and I've been involved in this prison process for decades. All right, I was actually chair of our committee council way back when they were discussing the validity of allowing rehabilitation centers to exist by themselves, and the community decided that it had to exist, coexist with a prison. Okay, that was one of the stipulations. So what we have heard today is good news. I want you to know this is very good news. I also I've always been concerned with the policy that our state has as far as a rehabilitation policy and how we want to approach rehabilitation with, and I should say probably what I've come to find is maybe the lack of, okay? And I think that's important as we move forward to understand our rehabilitation policy. And I think it's real important to the inmates. It's real important to recidivism. It's real important to reentry. It's real important to the success of reentry. So obviously, Palmer Correctional is a very important piece, I believe, in that process because of what they have to offer now, what they have had to offer in the past, and I think what they can offer in the future, and what we can offer toward forming a rehabilitation policy going forward as a state. I think it's important that we realize the problem isn't just crime. The problem is how we treat those who have been convicted and how we treat those who are going to be set back out onto the street. So I do want to thank the commissioner, but I had a few questions, and some of them have already been answered by the commissioner. And but I do know that Palmer, I mean that the Department of Public Safety, I believe in the past has had like about a $250,000 allocation or fund for recruitment of police officers, and I believe that has worked, or troopers rather, that has worked for them. And I know that it hasn't really been so with correctional officers. And I'm wondering whether we can hopefully move in that direction to help aid, because I think the number we need, and you correct me if I'm wrong, Commissioner, at least 80 more officers to open PCC successfully. But I'm sure we can do it in a process, and I don't know where you're at, I'm just guessing, a process where we'll do it in increments to where we won't have to actually need that. But I also I would like an answer on whether that's a possibility. But I also I guess you had answered my second question, whether PCC was going to be involved, and apparently it is, and the recognition of what it can provide is. But I would like to know whether that type of funding through the chair could be is going to happen for the Department of Corrections.
Commissioner Dahlstrom, I think the question was, is there a pot of money, $250,000 perhaps, available to incent DOC correctional officer recruitment?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Rep. Rauscher, I will tell you that if the legislature would like to add any recruitment dollars to my budget, that is totally your call, but I would be thrilled with that happening. I did ask for some money to assist in that area. It wasn't a quarter of $1 million, but I would love that. And I also want to thank you for your comments about reentry and let you know that I feel strongly, as you expressed, reentry is extremely important, and nationwide, not just in our state, but nationwide, people are realizing the value and the importance of reentry, because we want folks to be better when they go out than when they came in.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Fields.
Okay.
Yeah. Through the chair, I just wanted to let my colleague know that I talked to the chairman of the Finance Subcommittee on DOC today to see if we could find room. I actually asked for a higher figure than that for recruitment funds for correctional officers. So I hope that that subcommittee can find those funds.
Okay. Representative Thompson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Through the chair, Commissioner, I'm sure this question probably doesn't need to be asked, but I was real pleased to hear that you're doing a $5,000 hiring bonus. That will help a lot. But has there been a wage survey done for correctional officers?
Through the chair, Rep. Thompson, I will have to get a date for you on the last time that was done. And, you know, I'm going to tell you, in my perfect world, I would love to adjust a lot of wages in the state. I'm going to have to get an exact date when that was done.
Maybe including the legislators' wages, too. Thank you very much.
No comment. Representative Shaw.
Thank you. And through the chair, Commissioner Dahlstrom, this is Laddie Shaw. According to Representative Rauscher, we're going to need 80 officers to open PCC. We're presently 90 short. At the last meeting that we had in January in Anchorage, in an overview of this, the recruiting pipeline, I think we were talking about 40, and we were also being realistic to how many would get through the pipeline. We're talking about the potential of only 15. So if we're talking about opening Palmer Correctional Center with the need of 80 officers, we're 90 short, we may only get 15 through the pipeline in a year, how can we possibly fill that void at the Palmer Correctional Center?
Through the chair, thank you, Representative Shaw. I feel confident with the changes that have been made internally that we will be able to do that. And I don't know if somebody misspoke before or what, but we do get more than 15 a year. And these jobs are high requirements and things that they need to go through, backgrounds, physicals, psych tests, all those things. So we get many more applications than those that actually make it through, but our success record is more than 15 a year. And we could get you some numbers, but I will tell you that as of today, there are 15 almost officers in the queue that have start dates, new officers.
Thank you, Commissioner.
I feel confident that we will be able to, as the time is appropriate, have sufficient officers to open Palmer.
Thank you, Commissioner Dahlstrom. At this time, I'm going to move to invited testimony. We have Joshua Wilson with Alaska Correctional Officers Association, and Jonathan Pistonik, the coordinator of Anchorage Reentry Coalition. We'll start with Mr. Wilson. Mr. Wilson, please put yourself on record and provide testimony on HB 187, and feel free also to comment on the news shared by the commissioner as well.
Hello, thank you for the opportunity to speak today. My name is Joshua Wilson. I've represented correctional officers for the last 7 years, and I thank you for the opportunity to speak today. To start, I just want to applaud Commissioner Dahlstrom's decision to cancel the Department of Corrections request for proposal and not utilize private prison. This decision promotes public safety and will protect Alaskans. I'll speak briefly on privatization and why I believe HB 187 is appropriate and something the legislature that we absolutely support and something we hope the legislature passes. Incarcerating Alaskans in out-of-state private prisons thousands of miles from their homes, communities, and support systems will result in more crime and more victims in our communities. Private prisons have failed to better facilitate rehabilitation and treatment of incarcerated Alaskans in the past because of their low standards. Given the opportunity, they will fail again. To borrow a line from the legislature last session, incarcerating Alaskans in private prisons equated to sending Alaskans to crime school. Three of Alaskans' worst gangs were created when Alaskans were housed in private prisons, the lowlifes, the Native Brotherhood, and the 1488. Alaskans tried private prisons. The results were horrific and gave us one of the highest recidivism rates in the country. As Representative Field cited, the 2016 Federal Department of Justice review into the use of private prisons found that private prisons simply do not provide the same level of correctional services, programs, and resources. They do not substantially save on costs, and as noted in the recent report by the Department of Office Inspector General, they do not maintain the same level of safety and security. One of the myths that I just want to bust right now is that private prisons do not save money. They increase recidivism, which increases victims, they endanger Alaskans, and they shift costs to the states. They do this by increased recidivism, by lack of visitation. Obviously, any Alaskans held in private prisons in the lower 48 are going to lose all visitation for the most part. That's best practices, keep people close to home. This is why in 2018, a bipartisan criminal justice bill signed by the President of the United States became law that required federal inmates to be incarcerated no more than 500 miles from their primary residence. Alaskans sent to private prisons in the lower 48 would be certainly further than 500 miles from home. That private prisons also lengthen incarceration stays by adding prison conduct violations and what generally hold people about 90 days more than state prisons. Punishment is determined by Alaskan judges and courts. Private prisons should not be allowed to increase their profit margins by extending a prisoner's sentence, resulting in increased costs for Alaska. Private prisons also regularly cherry-pick prisoners, leaving the ones with medical conditions or the more violent or sex offenders out. They also have reduced safety and security by less checks of Alaskan prisoners, less staff, less transparency, and lower standards of staff. Medical expenses are often pushed onto the state. Transportation costs are all borne by the state, so traveling back and forth. Also, administrative costs are still something that are not included. Litigation costs are something that's not included. But then some of the largest hidden costs, the economic impact on the Alaskan communities. Millions of dollars being sent out of state, lost jobs, increased crime in our communities, and something that can't be viewed in simple economic terms is victimization. Victimization severely impacts Alaska in many ways, including quality of life, tourism, economic growth, among many others. Regarding recruitment and retention, if a recruitment and retention campaign was initiated today and utilized the funds that the legislature appropriated for Palmer Correctional Center, we could have Palmer Correctional Center up within Palmer Minimum up within 5 months and Palmer Minimum up with Medium up within 9 months. Per the DOC's own analysis in the spring of 2019. We know this is possible because when Goose Creek was opened, the DOC increased by 108 correctional officers in a 10-month period between 2012 and 2013. As a comparison, currently the Department of Public Safety has a budget of over $1.6 million for recruitment and advertising for a department of 761 employees. The DOC does not have a dedicated recruitment team made up of officers like APD or DPS, and the DOC does not have a budget component for either recruitment or advertising. Additionally, officer applicants currently have to pay for their medical screening. Troopers and APD don't do this. These barriers to recruitment have resulted in fewer correctional officers. Today, there are over two dozen fewer correctional officers than a year ago. In conclusion, just a couple more comments. I want to again applaud the commissioner's decision to cancel the DOC's RFP and not utilize private prisons. The use of private prisons is still in the governor's proposed budget, but given the commissioner's announcement today, I assume that will be revised. On multiple occasions, Alaskans decided private prisons do not make sense for Alaska and voted against them. Alaskans deserve better than being warehoused thousands of miles away with almost zero interaction with their families, village elders, and mentors to help them become productive members of their cities, towns, and villages. Alaska should heed the lessons it has already learned. Private prisons are interested only in increasing their profits to their shareholders. Do not save Alaska money and decrease public safety. The Alaska Correctional Officers Association fully supports the passage of SB 187, which will protect all Alaskans. Thank you again for the opportunity to speak with you today, and thank you for prioritizing public safety.
Thank you, Mr. Wilson. Any questions from the committee? Next, an invited testimony, Jonathan Pistonik, coordinator of Anchorage Reentry Coalition. Mr. Pistonik, please put yourself on the record and present your testimony on HB 187.
Through the chair, good afternoon. For the record, my name is Jonathan Pistotnik. I'm a resident of Anchorage and the coordinator for the Anchorage Reentry Coalition. I'd just like to say that although I think many people that I work with in the community share my sentiments, I'm just speaking on behalf of myself, and I appreciate the opportunity to speak. I guess I would also like to applaud DOC's effort or DOC's repeal of their RFP, the rolling back of that. I have a prepared statement that I prepared prior to this news that I guess I'd like to go on record and read that. And I'd like to state my support for HB 187. As someone that helps support prisoner reentry into the community on a full-time basis as the coordinator for the Anchorage Reentry Coalition, I believe that the sending of inmates out of state to private prisons would be detrimental. It'd be detrimental to those individuals sent out of state to be further isolated and removed from their homes and their culture, detrimental to the families of the individuals sent out of state, to the wives and children and parents, and detrimental to those of us engaged in prisoner reentry work throughout Alaska and the communities that will bear the burden of rehabilitation. I support this House bill's effort, or the intent of this House bill and its efforts to keep inmates inside Alaska. Although I have many concerns about the prior intent to send more than 500 Alaskans out of state, I would just like to make 2 points. Although I'm mainly engaged in community organizing around prisoner reentry efforts, I do go into correctional institutions when I can to educate inmates about reentry programs and services that are available in the community. And in doing so, I hope to motivate and encourage them to seek out the services that they may need when they are released, and to basically just answer any questions that they have about the resources that are available in the community when they come back.
I see.
Education, awareness, motivation, encouragement, the building of trust in those short visits I'm afforded are key to my work and that of my partners in the community that make similar efforts to engage with inmates prior to their release. Drawing upon my background in public health, I believe that it takes time to build that trust and knowledge necessary to make real change in this context. So I would ask, like, how will those of us engaging in and promoting reentry be able to meaningfully engage with someone that is housed in a prison thousands of miles away in, say, Arizona or Colorado for 5 or 10 years? I can't help but think that it would be a serious step backwards for those of us in the community that are engaged in this work if men are sent out of state with no opportunity to hear our messaging. The second concern that I have is the exposure to prison gang culture that is likely to occur when Alaskan inmates are sent to facilities that are warehousing inmates from other states. I've never been privy to a discussion or meeting amongst my reentry partners in Anchorage in which gang affiliation has ever been a practical concern of ours when working with someone that has been released from incarceration. The only time it really comes up is when we reflect on the time when inmates were sent outside and that how it bolstered small-time cliques that were in existence here. And this is because prison gang culture and street gang culture does not exist in Alaska the same way that it does in the lower 48. And in the parlance of the streets, it just isn't as hardcore in Alaska or in Anchorage. My concern is that if men are sent out of state and warehoused in private prisons where they will be exposed to prison and street gang cultures and either learn or be forced to adopt that type of lifestyle, when they return, and they will return, they will bring that gang culture back with them. And as we know, 95% of inmates are eventually released. So my concern is that the gang culture would eventually permeate into the community and simply make everyone less safe. In closing, I would just like to reiterate my support for House Bill 187 and any efforts that the legislature proposes, or in fact DOC, for that matter, to keep Alaskans in Alaska. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Any questions from the committee? Thank you. And for both of the invited testifiers, if you have written testimony to get it into the House record, please send that to hsta@akledge.gov. That's halibut, sockeye, tongass, abalone @akledge.gov. It's a District 35 acronym. And that's going to take us to, I think, a really quick summary of the amendment from Representative Jackson, and we're going to consider amendments next week on Tuesday. Yes, Representative Story, do you have a question?
I just had a couple follow-up questions to all of the testimony and comments that had been priorly made, and that was, I heard the request to, if there was a survey on wages, I would like the survey to include benefits as part of that package. And then also, I had heard that, if I got this correct, 51% of people are unsentenced who are in our facilities. And I thought I might have heard the commissioner say she's sent a request to the Department of Law for, I don't know, no? Anyway, what can be, I guess my question is, I would like more information on that, and what can be done about that?
I see Deputy Commissioner Good in the back, and she registered those requests for information, especially on benefits as a part of the salary comparison. The 51% statistic is frankly shocking to me, that half the prison population is not sentenced. And I don't want to go down that rabbit hole today, but I suspect that can be fodder for another committee hearing, because that is just a sensational statistic. Representative Vance?
Yes, thank you. I do have some questions about the bill itself.
Yeah. Representative Fields?
Let's see. I'm not sure who I should direct the first question to, but would this bill limit the state's ability to transport prisoners within the state?
No. Within the state?
Mm-hmm.
No. It would not limit.
Follow up?
Representative Vance.
I was just wondering what defines facility in this chapter, because I'm thinking about the conversations around public safety concerning the tribes and the rural villages, and I know that the state often contracts with municipalities and others for use of prisons to be able to house someone, and then they transport them to a prison, a better facility. With that in mind, would these facilities that are being used on a temporary basis be considered public, since you're wanting to exclude private? I just want to make sure that we're looking to the future for the conversations that are happening with the tribes, because they are not the same as our current recognized municipalities in when it comes to law jurisdiction.
Through the chair, that was clearly the intent clearly was not to preclude such arrangements that exist today through public entities and tribes as sovereign governments. I would hope would be considered public, but happy to double check with Ledge Legal.
Thank you.
Any other questions for the sponsor from the committee? Okay. At this point, we'll hear from you, Mr. Verhagen, and note on process, we'll take up all amendments on Tuesday, so you can kind of give us a sneak preview. We can the seed is planted, so to speak. It can cultivate itself over the weekend, and then we'll take the amendment up for a vote on Tuesday and leave it to you or in your office to find a sponsor on the committee to offer the amendment. Mr. Verhagen.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Elijah Verhagen, staff to Representative Jackson. So you have the committee, all should have this amendment before you. I'll just briefly go through what it exactly does. On page 2, line 7, as written, on page 2, line 7, there's or which will be deleted just so we can add a third bullet point. And then on page 2, line 9, following the word prisoner, we would insert the third bullet that says, to reduce the cost of housing a prisoner who is not a resident of the state or who has been sentenced to a term or aggregate term of imprisonment of 99 years or more. Then the second portion of that amendment is just basically doing the same thing further on down in the bill, deleting or to add the third bullet point to insert the exact same language or very similar language. And I would note this is not something that the commissioner has to do, but it as written, unless the commissioner finds in writing that agreement with an agency outside the state is necessary to reduce the cost of housing a prisoner and so on. So it's not something they have to do, but it is something that they could do. As you know, the commissioner is online and they can have, you know, better numbers, but I was told right before this meeting the 99 years is easily changed by you guys. That's what legal wrote up, but how they calculate it, people that would most likely not be ever released or pass away before they're released is around 200 in the state. And so my boss, Representative Jackson's, our idea and working with Representative Fields is that these people are not going to be re-entering society. And as talked about, my boss completely supports the bill. And as far as we do want to help people re-enter society in Alaska and Alaskans to stay in Alaska, this is solely dealing with non-residents, which that's even a much smaller number, and those that are basically having a life sentence, even though it's not termed a life sentence. And with that, I can take any questions if the committee has it.
Any questions from the committee?
Well, I have questions. When do we take it up next?
Stand by for Tuesday for Mr. Thompson. Great, we'll set that aside. Thank you for the preview, Mr. Verhagen. I'm going to set an amendment deadline for HB 187 for 5 p.m. on Monday, January 27th, and we'll take this bill back up on Tuesday, January 28th, including public testimony. And if it's the will of the committee, take action or just sort of see where things are at that point. Thank you, Representative Fields, and we'll go at ease as we do musical chairs.
Jack, I think we have a presentation on HJR 15 from staff to Representative Christ Hopkins, so please put yourself on record and proceed. I would note this is the second hearing in House State Affairs on this resolution.
Yeah, for the record, Kevin McGowan, staff to Representative Christ Tompkins. Today we're presenting HJR 15, which was first introduced by Representative Christ Tompkins in April of last year. This constitutional amendment would lower the veto override threshold for appropriations bills, the vote threshold from 3/4 of legislators, so 45 votes, to 2/3 of legislators, 40 votes. Currently, vetoes of non-appropriations bills in Alaska require veto overrides require 2/3, so 40 votes. HGR 15 would create a uniform veto override vote threshold, so same for both appropriation bills and non-appropriation bills. Alaska's threshold is very disproportionate to every other state. We have the highest by far, and Josiah is going to elaborate on that a bit.
Through the chair, for the record, I'm Josiah Nash, intern for Representative Christ Tompkins. So as Kevin just mentioned, Alaska is the only state in the union with a 3/4 veto override vote threshold for appropriation bills. Every other state has a 2/3, 3/5, or a simple majority vote threshold. As you can see on the slide above, 38 states have a two-thirds threshold, 6 states have a three-fifths threshold, and 5 states have a simple majority threshold. This leaves Alaska, as you can see right up there in the corner, by itself as the only state with a high three-fourths vote threshold.
For the record, Kevin McGowan, staff for Representative Christ Tompkins. Rep. Christ Tompkins now is going to come up to field questions and talk a little bit more about it.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. For the record, Jonathan Christ Tompkins, District 35. I introduced this last April before any vetoes were made in the last budget cycle. I think partly because this is a sort of anomaly in our Constitution that I've always been aware of, but also I think to some extent saw the train wreck coming down the tracks and wanted to make sure there was a vehicle. And I think really broadly, even independent of different points of view on the budget last year, the vetoes, whether the vetoes should have been overridden, this is just sort of objectively and on its face sort of something where we're way out of line from the rest of the country, literally. I mean, we're the only state in the union. It's also worth noting that Alaska as a territory, our territorial legislature had a two-thirds override threshold for all measures, appropriations or not. And if you look at the minutes in the Constitutional Convention, there was a lot of discussion. There were sort of two camps, whether we should be three-quarters or just have a uniform two-thirds threshold. Of course, the three-quarters camp won by vote in the Constitutional Convention, but the very concerns that were thrown forward by the folks in the Constitutional Convention advocating two-thirds are sort of exactly the situation that we've seen throughout history in Alaska whenever the legislative branch of government has sought to put a check on the executive branch of government. The last thought I want to put on the record is, put aside the current situation around the budget, if you have an administration with really any perspective, ideologically or philosophically, having a three-quarters override threshold effectively gives the executive branch and that administration a blank check to execute their agenda and their vision through the veto pen. So if you have a environmentalist governor in Alaska, 2 terms from now, and that governor just wants to end the mining industry in Alaska and line item veto division of mining land and water in the DNR budget, that governor very well is likely going to be able to do that because the override threshold is so incredibly high. So, regardless of who is in the executive branch and who the administration is, there's a clear imbalance in the separation of powers in Alaska. And as we've seen in the other 49 states, HGR 15 seeks to rebalance the separation of powers.
Thank you. Are there questions for the sponsor? Representative Story.
Thank you for bringing this forward. I think that it's important to hear from the public about their thoughts about this. I know just in general, when people have asked, how much does it take to override in hearing it's 45 out of 60, it's been a surprise by that high amount from people that I've talked to. And I think it's important that we try and inform our constituents about the opportunity for public testimony coming up on this so we can hear more about that.
Okay. Not seeing other questions from the committee. Representative Christ Hopkins.
And just a final comment for the record, this is something that Kevin sort of dug up yesterday. I think sort of one other fact for the committee to consider is whenever in a constitutional framework you have two different override thresholds, one for appropriation measures and one for non-appropriation measures, it also inherently creates constitutional ambiguity about what is an appropriation and what isn't, versus when you just have a uniform, flat override threshold, it's two-thirds for everything, appropriation, non-appropriation. And that's not just an academic concern. In the 90s, in the Knowles administration, Governor Knowles vetoed a bill from the legislature that gave the University of Alaska a large holding of land for its land grant status. I think that was the context of the bill. The legislature passed it. Governor Knowles vetoed it. And the legislature sought to override the veto. The legislature mustered the two-thirds override threshold, but not the three-quarters override threshold. And Governor Knowles said, wait, I'm going to call that an appropriation bill because it's moving an asset, land, into the university. And so the legislature sued the governor saying, actually not an appropriation bill. We got the two-thirds required, even though we didn't get the three-quarters. And like we overrode that veto, and we want our bill to go through. So it went to the Alaska Supreme Court, and the legislature at the time, controlled by Republicans, prevailed. And so we have a little bit more clarity, but it's just to say when you create, instead of just having a flat uniform threshold for overrides and you create two categories of override threshold, you create ambiguity and the lawyers make off like bandits as a result. So I think that's just sort of one other consideration for the committee to consider.
Thanks. Representative Shaw had a question.
Yes, through the chair. Representative Christ Tompkins, you noted that at the Constitutional Convention, originally it was two-thirds vote across the board?
Representative Shaw, through the chair, the territorial legislature, before we became state, just had a flat two-thirds threshold. At the Constitutional Convention, there was debate about this very subject, some people saying we should have two-thirds, some saying we should have three-quarters, and then the three-quarters camp won out in that debate.
I was just curious because this article was amended in 1976, and I don't know which part of that two-thirds or three-quarters was amended, if anything, but that article was amended in some aspect in 1976. If you could maybe give me an idea of how that came about or what the specifics were.
Yeah, absolutely, Representative Shaw. I don't know that offhand, but we'll know on Tuesday. That's a great question.
Okay, not seeing further questions from committee members, I don't believe we have any invited testimony, so we'll go to public testimony on Tuesday, January 28th, and if it's the will of the committee, can move the bill, the resolution at that time. The amendment deadline for this bill is 5 p.m. Monday, January 27th, and with that, I believe we are adjourned.